This is the history of America in poems, and this is the last segment we're going to cover on children's poetry. And I am exhausted. I am so tired. This has been a long journey. But this is the last gasp. We're going to start talking about Dr. Seuss. And Dr. Seuss, his real name was Theodore Geisel, and he wrote from the 1950s. His last book came out in 1990. And Joseph T. Thomas Jr. wrote an essay in the Cambridge Anthology where he pretty much agreed with Angela Sorby, who was another essayist in the same anthology. And they both agreed that children's poetry is always discounted by academics and dismissed as doggerel. And I think most people, other than parents and kids themselves, might feel this way. And but Joseph T. Thomas Jr. talks about how Dr. Seuss was influenced heavily by Dada and Surrealism, and his work has visual echoes of Cubism, and the same traits are apparent in his adult paintings. And he also used collage-like juxtapositions in his visual work. And in his text writing, he had a love of chance and words appearing together on lists, because he would work off of these word lists from publishers for age groups. And he actually enjoyed doing this because he felt it turns out he could be more creative and inventive. And Thomas Jr. talks about the inventive nonsense of Dr. Seuss and the gripping narrative and the infectious rhythm, the use of anapest and a kind of meter that propels narration forward. He's a great poet to study rhythm in narrative and rhythm and character, and just probably the best American poet to do that with. So I think it's a shame that he is discounted by academics, because I think he is one of America's most important poets. And so Thomas Jr. in the Cambridge Anthology starts talking about A Cat in the Hat, which was the early big hit by Dr. Seuss, and how the book starts in reverse meter because the house will soon be turned upside down. And he talks about his rhythmic nuances in that book, and also his use of limerick over his career of writing for children. And I would like to add that Dr. Seuss used some amazing metaphors, and he was unique in his ability to explain hard concepts and ideas with tight and imaginative poetry that combined with his really fantastical landscapes and characters made him unmatched among children's writers, not just as a children's poet, but just as an American poet. He's the most unusual and inventive. And I put a lot of links to a lot of Dr. Seuss pieces on the page, on the children's podcast page. And a lot of these lead to online picture books. And although these are less printable than just, there's a few that link directly to the text of the books, they're also good because you can actually experience the book with the illustrations. And that's probably the best way to read Dr. Seuss, is in context with the illustrations. The first poem is that the first book that he ever did was called On Beyond Zebra from 1955, and that's not available online, so I put that in the treasure hunt section. And then Cat in the Hat we won't be talking about, but that came out in 1957 with a word constraint list of 348 words that were given to him by the publisher to focus on the vocabulary of early readers. And the first book that I have added a link for us to read is called And to Think I Saw It on Mulberry Street from 1937, which is about exaggeration, American exaggeration in a way, and the imagination of children, sensationalism, turning a story into a big sensational story, and just in general bigness, the bigness of the kid's story when he comes home to relay what he saw on Mulberry Street. So the next one is called McGilliatt's Pool, and it's from 1947. And it's a good poem about imagination and fishing for things and catching things and just this idea of discovery, how you have to go fishing if you're going to discover something. And you never know what you're going to discover. The next story in the list is Thidwick, the Big-Hearted Moose from 1948. Let me take a sip of tea here. I just want to say for those who these days feel Dr. Seuss is too woke, which there is that group of people, this story could actually be read as about the welfare state. So take a look at this one and see what you think of this one. It's definitely a site of conflict, and it's about American practicality. And that's Thidwick, the Big-Hearted Moose from 1948. The next one is an unusual one that a lot of people don't know. My dad, like I said before, my dad was a huge fan of Dr. Seuss, and so I had like an encyclopedic set of Dr. Seuss books, and I'll put a picture of those on the page. But I had some kind of like lesser known Dr. Seuss stories that I was familiar with because they were in this set, and one of them was Scrambled Egg Supper from 1953. And I did some research about this era because, and it's why I included the story in the set, and it's because around 1953, in the 1950s, Americans were starting to care more about food and cooking. And there was a big push for women to re-domesticate and go back into housekeeping after World War II. And a lot of women had gone out into the workforce during World War II because there was a lack of labor. And so when men came home from World War II, women were encouraged to take back up housekeeping and cooking. And so Americans for the first time maybe started to become foodies, even though it was also an era of food technology and there was a lot of processed foods and a lot of convenience foods that were coming onto the market, like TV dinners and canned soup and frozen vegetables and things like this, and cream of soup. Cream of mushroom soup that, as you know, is used as a binder in casseroles. And casseroles were a big deal in the 1950s. I love casseroles. This is interesting to me. Jell-O and gelatin molded salads and desserts were a big deal. I just bought my first molded fish, which I needed it's like a little fish mold that I needed for a Vincent Price recipe I made last year. But a lot of kitchens in the 50s had these food molds hanging on the wall. Even into the 70s, when I grew up, kind of ironically, people would still put up those on the walls, even though they didn't use them. Spam was a big 1950s food, and we're not going to talk about this, but Dr. Seuss has a famous book called Green Eggs and Ham that came out in 1960, and it's another food book that kind of alludes to Spam. But there's a post-war domestic experimentation going on, the new technologies, and also the fact that the World War II soldiers have been exposed to international food, and they come home and they kind of want their wives to start making these international recipes, and so Italian food starts to come into the cookbooks. There's still the traditional and hearty American dishes known as meatloaf and pot roast and all the casseroles and the cheese balls and the ham with pineapple. So, like, creating food and cooking now is starting to become a big deal in identity making. And I think that's what this Dr. Seuss story is about, because this character goes out looking for the perfect egg for his scrambled egg. And he goes to every single bird he can possibly find to try to find that perfect best egg so that he can have a perfect scrambled eggs. And so it's part of, like, identity making, cult of self-invention. You cook up a self. You're cooking up your own self. So that's not a famous one, but I think it's a fun one. The next one is Horton Hears a Who, which is a very pivotal, famous Dr. Seuss story from 1954. And it was inspired, allegedly, according to Thomas Jr., the essay in the Cambridge Anthology, It was inspired by two pictures falling on top of each other. And that's how he was inspired to create a story about the Whos in Whoville, this whole town called Whoville, of very small, tiny people. And they're going to show up again in the Christmas story. But they first make an appearance here in Horton Hears a Who, and it's about an elephant who has to protect this whole world. And he has to go up against bullies and cruelty, and this is sites of conflict anytime there's bullying. But he has to help people understand that these Whos are people. And there's this whole we are here personhood that's being fought for in this story. And at the resolution, it's one extra yop, which is a sound that the Whos in Whoville make, that put it over, that make themselves heard. So I think similar to the Christmas story in Yertle the Turtle that we'll talk about next, these are not heroic characters. These are very ordinary characters who do just one thing that puts it over. And I think Dr. Seuss, as a student of fascism, kind of knew how to explain the fall of fascism. And that's, Dr. Seuss was a very political writer. He used to write political cartoons long before he became a children's author. So that kind of non-heroic heroics shows up in a lot of his books. The first one, Horton Hears a Who, 1954. So then Yertle the Turtle is next. And this was published in 1958. This was my father's absolute favorite. And he used to try to tell me the subtext of it when he read it to me. And Thomas Jr. would say here, meter matters in the story. Meter is very important to the propulsion of the narrative. And I would also ask you, when you read this story, to decide and maybe think about which turtle you are in this stack of turtles that Dr. Seuss talks about. It's a site of conflict. The story is about a challenge to authority. There's a quote in it that says, down at the bottom, we too should have rights. And then again, the thing that puts it over is not just a yop sound from a who from Whoville, but it's a burp from that turtle on the bottom. So another poem that was essentially about the fall of fascism. The next story is not available to us online, so I put it in the treasure hunt, but I love it. It's called it's a Dr. Seuss story called Gertrude McFuzz, and it's from 1958, and it's about envy and the extremes we go in for the beauty culture. So it's about cult of self, and the character goes through elaborate measures to get this beautiful plumage on her body, and then at the end she gives it up because, the quote is at the very end, Dr. Seuss says, because now she's smarter. So that's a delightful story if you can find it. Probably one of my favorite Dr. Seuss stories myself is called Sneetches, and it's from 1961, and it's a very popular one because it was turned into a cartoon that we watched along with The Lorax, which was turned into a television cartoon, and so was The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. And the reason I like it, I think it's the most American Dr. Seuss story that he did, and maybe one of the most American poems. There's another one at the end that I'm going to say this about for Dr. Seuss, but this is definitely hits a lot of the themes that we've been talking about. Exclusion, and inclusion, capitalism, the beauty cult, racial differences, the cult of self, sites of conflict, challenges to authority, fads, tech fads, disruptions, tangled threads. This has everything in it. It's an amazing story. So if you read very few of these, make sure you read Sneetches from 1961. The next one is called Zax. It's from 1954, but it was also included in the 1961 book, The Sneetches. It was the Sneetches book was called The Sneetches and Other Stories, and one of them was the Zax. And this is definitely a poem that describes the world right now as one big site of conflict. It's just a story about conflict, and people who refuse to compromise and what happens to them. So that's a great story. It's very short, so it's an easy one to read. Another one of my favorites was a story called What Was I Scared Of from 1961 also. And it is a story that uses sympathy or empathy as a way of overcoming difference, overcoming personal differences. So it's definitely a story about multitudes, just differences in people or characters. I can't say that Dr. Seuss, they're not really humans, but they're characters, they're people, and that fear is just another side of conflict. That's what I think is wonderful about this story, is that fear is depicted as just another side of conflict that you can overcome. The next story is another obscure story that I picked out called I Had Trouble Getting to Sala Salu from 1965. And it's a road poem, definitely a travel poem, about the road of troubles and the troubles that you can't road away from. It's self-help, it's cult of self, it's self-improvement through location change, all of these things in this journey that this character goes, trying to get to Sala Salu, because he thinks his life will be better in Sala Salu. 1965, that was. The next story is called I Can Lick 30 Tigers Today, and I think this is another obscure one from 1969, and it's a kind of about, well, it's entirely about bullshitting and bravado and bluffing and making sensational claims. King Louis Katz from 1969 is about entitlement and challenges to authority. The Lorax, one of his most famous stories from 1971, about capitalism. There's a line in it that says, business is business. And it ends with this wonderful line, wonderful little set of lines. Unless somebody like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. So it's a huge book that is a site of conflict between environmental damage and big business. And we should reread it again in light of the dawn of the big data centers. So it's relevant again, The Lorax from 1971. And we have three more stories I'm going to talk about. One is called The Butter Battle Book from 1984. And I'm actually going to read a part of this because it's about the culture wars and what Dr. Seuss calls wars that are not yours. They're your grandparents' wars or your parents' wars. They're older people wars that we still fight because we inherit these cultural ideas. This is incredibly complicated idea for kids, but it's wonderful. Exceptionalism, it deals with nationalism. It deals with cultural differences and unscalable escalations of warfare. And definitely it's about sites of conflict and multitudes. So it's a poem. It came out kind of when I was an adult. It came out past my childhood, and it was also turned into a TV special. But a grandfather is talking to his grandson, and he has convinced him that people that butter their bread on different sides should hate each other. And so these different civilizations just butter their, one butters their bread on the top and one butters their bread on the bottom. And this is the reason they hate each other. And so the grandfather talks about there being a right, honest way of buttering the bread. And so you can't trust a zook who spreads bread underneath. Every zook must be watched. He has kinks in his soul. And that's why as a youth, I made watching my goal. Watching zooks for the zook watching border patrol. It's got a border patrol. And it talks about keeping the country safe from the people that butter their bread on a different side. And then trying to fight them with fancier soldier suits and fancier slingshots to shoot. And they came up with this triple sling jigger. With my triple sling jigger, I sure felt much bigger. How weapons make you feel bigger. I marched to the wall with a great vim and great vigor, right up to vantage with my hand on the trigger. I'll have no more nonsense, I said with a frown. from Zooks Who Eat Bread with the Butter Side Down. Craziness. And so later he says something like, they failed a battle because we didn't do and we didn't quite die, which is Dr. Seuss making fun of the phrase do or die and how senseless that is. So is there anything else I want to read from this? Pretty much that's it. The end is heartbreakingly, it's a heartbreaking cliffhanger. Let me just say that. It's worth reading just for the cliffhanger. So the next book, this is the last book that Dr. Seuss, it's not going to be the last book we talk about, but it's the last book in verse that, the last book period that Dr. Seuss published before he died. And it's called Oh, the Places You'll Go from 1990. And I have to say that I, when this book came out, I didn't even read it. I didn't even read it until a few weeks ago because I always thought this was a gift book for college kids or high school kids who had just graduated, and I skipped it. I just didn't think it was an interesting topic or that it would have anything interesting to say, and I don't know why I thought that about my beloved Dr. Seuss, but I did. And so I have to say that that is completely not what this book is about. It is a very dark book, and it should be read by people who have lived a life of hard knocks and hard times. And I'm really not sure it's a kid's book, but I am definitely sure kids should read it. And because Dr. Seuss is considered a children's author, most people would skip it. And so I definitely wanted to include it kind of as a bookend to those other two adult poems we started this class with. But it's about travel. It's a road poem for sure, as life is a road. And it's about freedom. It's about fame. It's about setting out with such great hopes when you're young and then having, it's definitely innocence to experience and the cult of self. I think this is one of the most American poems I have ever read. Definitely one of the most American poems that Dr. Seuss created. And I'm going to read a lot of it because it is just such an amazing thing. And I can't believe I didn't read it before now, considering my great love for this author. But it starts out as a, I think they give it to college students to kind of like maybe to give some college students some humility, but I really just don't feel like you can relate to this unless you've lived a full life that's had some disappointments in it. So the character starts out, don't you worry, don't stew, just go right along. You'll start happening too, because you're a person who's gonna happen. It's just an amazing way to say it. I'm gonna continue on. You'll be on your way up. You'll be seeing great sights. You'll join the high flyers who soar to high heights. So there's great hope here. You're starting out on your career, your endeavors. You won't lag behind because you'll have the speed. You'll pass the whole gang and you'll soon take the lead. Wherever you fly, you'll be the best of the best. Wherever you go, you will top all the rest. American competition right there, except when you don't, because sometimes you won't. So bad things are going to happen. I'm sorry to say so, but sadly it's true. The bang-ups, the hang-ups can happen to you. You can get all hung up in a prickly perch, and your gang will fly on. You'll be left in the lurch. You'll come down from the lurch with an unpleasant bump, and then chances are then that you'll be in a slump. And when you're in a slump, you're not in for much fun. Unslumping yourself is not easily done. You will come to a place where the streets are not marked. Some windows are lighted, but mostly they're darked. A place you could sprain both your elbow and chin. Do you dare to stay out? Do you dare to go in? How much can you lose? How much can you win? And if you go in, should you turn left or right? Or right in 3/4? And maybe, not quite? Or go around back and sneak in from behind? Simple it's not, I'm afraid you will find, for a mind maker upper to make up his mind. You can get so confused that Well, let me start again. You can get so confused that you'll start into race down long wiggled roads at a breaknecking pace and grind on for miles cross weirdish wild space, headed, I fear, toward a most useless place, the waiting place. For people just waiting, waiting for a train to go, or a bus to come, or a plane to go, or the mail to come, or the rain to go, or the phone to ring, or the snow to snow, or the waiting around for a yes or no, or waiting for their hair to grow. Everyone is just waiting, waiting for the fish to bite, or waiting for the wind to fly a kite, or waiting around for Friday night, or waiting perhaps for their brother Jake, or a pot to boil, or a better break, or a string of pearls, or a pair of pants, or a wig with curls, or another chance. Everyone is just waiting. Let's skip a few stanzas. But you're ready for anything under the sky, ready because you're that kind of guy. Oh, the places you'll go, there is fun to be done. There are points to be scored, there are games to be won. And the magical things you can do with that ball will make you the winningest winner of all. Fame. You'll be as famous can be, with the whole wide world watching you win on TV, except when they don't, because sometimes they won't. I'm afraid that sometimes you'll play lonely games too, games you can't win, because you'll play against you. Oh my God. Hey, that's a lot. All alone, whether you like it or not, alone will be something you'll be quite a lot. And when you're alone, there's a very good chance you'll meet things that scare you right out of your pants. There are some down the road between hither and yon that can scare you so much that you won't want to go on. But go on you will, but on you will go, though the winter be foul, on you will go your enemies prowl. On you will go through the hacken cracks howl, onward up many a frightening creek, though your arms may get sore and your sneakers may leak. Oh, and on you will hike, and I know you'll hike far and face up to your problems, whatever they are. You'll get mixed up, of course, as you already know. You get mixed up. You'll get mixed up with the strange birds as you go. So be sure when you step with care and great tact. And remember that life's a great balancing act. So reread that. It's an amazing poem. And I butchered it in many places, but it actually also might have been turned into a TV special. I'll look and check on that and see if it exists. And if it does, I'll link to it in on the class page. This reminds me to link to all the TV specials. The Grinch That Stole Christmas is the last one. It's the most famous, from 1957. There's a lot of argument in America about what Christmas means every single year. There's signs all over my city in different neighborhoods of people trying to assert their ideas of what Christmas means. And it's a big site of conflict in America. And there's a tension between the materialism of it and religion and inclusion and who we should include and not include and just basically good faith. All a big site of conflict. So one of the most important Dr. Seuss stories. We'll end with that Christmas poem, just like we started with a Christmas poem. And I know I said that Dr. Seuss was unique in the world of children's literature, but I can think of another visionary who speaks to children through sensational and imaginative characters in order to say some pretty hard things. And that's Jim Henson. And so I've left a little Jim Henson at the end of the class. I've left a link to the song The Rainbow Connection, which was actually written by Paul Williams and Kenneth Asher. But it's a very, very American lyric, and it speaks to inventing the self. And it's literally sung from the point of view of one of his most hopeful dreamers, that being Kermit the Frog. And I think this song is just as much as an American folk song as anything else I can think of. And that pretty much ends our lectures on children's poetry in America. And I hope you check out some of the writing exercise prompts on the class page and try out your own children's cadences and rhythms and rhyme schemes. And check the treasure hunts and the extra reading if you want to keep on going beyond the poems that we're focusing on in this podcast. So thanks for joining, and I'll see you in the next class.